مصطفى وسام was saying, because be well aware, she speaks Arabic perfectly well. Okay, she understands Arabic perfectly well. Probably. Okay, before introducing our lecture, I want to mention something. We usually hold our sessions every first Wednesday of the month. But due to the holy month of Ramadan, which will start, I think, 15th or 16th of this month, so the next session will be on the third Wednesday of June, which will be on the 20th. And our lecturer will be also a professor, well known among most of you. Her name is Dr. Christine Ajrouche. She is a professor of sociology in the Eastern Michigan University, and she will be talking about effective strategies to help youth cope with prejudice and discrimination. That's for next month. Now to Dr. Salih Howard. I know that you know most of those who are present, and I know a lot of them know you very well. But Dr. Salih Howell is the director of the Center for Arab American Studies and associate professor of history at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. She had her bachelor degree in Middle East Studies from Davidson College. Where is this Davidson College? Okay. She had her master's degree in American culture from University of Michigan, and in the year 2009, she received her PhD from the American culture program at University of Michigan. She had written and co-written many books, included Citizenship and Crisis, Arab Detroit 9/11, Life in the Terror Decade 2011, and, which is the most important book she had written about, Old Islam in Detroit, Rediscovering the Muslim American Past. And this book was named a Michigan Notable Book by the Library of Michigan and given the Evelyn Shaker or Shakir?
Shaker.
Evelyn Shaker Award by the Arab American National Museum. Professor Howell is currently completing a book entitled Halal, Why Halal? You'll tell us about that later. Halal Metropolis, Mosque, Markets, and Neighborhood Development, which explores the mutual constitution of local publics and religious minorities across the urban and suburban landscape in Michigan. Please help me welcome Professor Dr. Sally Howell.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. I'm flattered to be here. My Arabic is not. I'd say I speak, you know, maybe Ashirin min Maya, so I can't really give a talk in Arabic. So I want to make sure I have my clock on so I don't talk too long. Okay, that'll keep me from speaking. So it's sort of awkward for me to give this lecture here, because presumably you are the history of the Arab community in Dearborn, of the Lebanese community in Dearborn, and it's kind of awkward for me to try and do this here. Ideally, you know quite a bit more about the history than I do. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give sort of a summary, an overview of the history of the Arabs in Dearborn. And can you see the screen over here? Are you okay? Yeah, I might want to move it back a little bit so people can see. Yeah, I want people to be able to see. Because more than anything, I don't even need the microphone. But anyway, you need it because of the paperwork. So, of course, the history of the Arab community in Dearborn, just like anywhere else in Michigan, begins in one place. It begins at the intersection of Woodward Avenue and Manchester in Highland Park, Michigan. I love these pictures. This is a Ford Motor Company. It was in 1914 when he offered his $5 workday. In 1912, there's a recording that Sheikh Khalil Bazi did with Alixanaf, a historian, that she recorded from him in the 1960s, where he talks about His brother had come to America before him with someone from the Turfey family. And they lived on, I can't think of the name of the street now, LaBelle, which was on the other side of Woodward from Manchester. And when he came to America, he didn't speak any English. His brother had sent him money for the passage, and he got off the boat at Ellis Island, and he had a big badge that his brother had sent for him that said, you know, from Ellis Island, take the streetcar to the train station, take this train to Cleveland, take that train to Detroit, get off. And here, his badge ended at this exit from the streetcar in Manchester. So he got off the streetcar, and he was very anxious. What am I going to do? Once I get off the streetcar, how am I going to find my brother? And he said, I got off the streetcar right here at this intersection right here. And he said, he looked around and everyone spoke Arabic. They were all Arabs. They were all from Vintage Bale. He was so happy. So people took him to his brother's house. So this Highland Park factory was a center for all the new immigrants who were arriving in Michigan, and really the new immigrants who were arriving in America this time. They heard about this $5 workday, and they came to Detroit. This is Robert Taylor and Henry Ford, who were, you know, sort of modernizing and really revolutionizing the labor force here in America. These are the kinds of people who worked here. The Highland Park factory had over 12,000 workers. This was like really revolutionary for the economy of the world that you could have these workers. Instead of building a car, you know, like one car at a time, they started just doing the assembly line production, and they could make hundreds of cars a week. But look at the percentage of that workforce. You know, 3/4 of it was foreign born. So it wasn't just the Lebanese who were arriving here at this time, right? All these different groups were arriving. The group on the left were the majority of the people who came to Detroit in this period. And when we think about Detroit today, it's a really Polish city. There were a lot of Russians here. There were a lot of Romanians, Italians, Hungarians. The group on the right, these were the Muslims. There were also a lot of Muslims who were coming in this period. Turks, Kurds, Syrians, Albanians, Indians. There were Polish, you know, the Tatars, Polish Muslims, Russian Muslims, Lithuanian Muslims. So there was a big community of Muslims here. Our immigration laws, however, changed in the 1920s. America, kind of like the period of Islamophobia and xenophobia that we're going through today, America got concerned at the very high percentage of foreign-born people who were coming into the country, and the fact that the foreign-born people weren't coming from England and Scotland and France. They were coming from Poland. They were coming from Eastern Europe, and they were coming from Southern Europe. So they were different from the majority of Americans who were Protestants in this time. So America, their xenophobia in this period was very fixated on Roman Catholics. They didn't like Roman Catholics. They thought Roman Catholics were going to corrupt American society, and the Pope was going to tell everybody what to do instead of Americans having freedom. This should sound familiar to you, because this is the way people talk about Islam today, that people want Sharia law, and we're going to lose our freedoms. The Immigration Act of 1924, the Johnson-Reed Act, was really put in place to prevent immigration very specifically from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. And it just so happened that it also cut off really almost all immigration from the Middle East. So we went from this period with lots of people coming to America to a period where there was really almost a freeze on immigration from the Arab world. There were exceptions. There were 100 visas a year that were given to Syrians. So that's not immigration. That's a trickle. It can make a difference, but not a real difference. So this is why we had this period of where the community, without all this new immigration, it had an easier time Americanizing, right? Because, you know, all the kids who were born here. You know, it just became a... So we had sort of this melting pot generation that took place in the 1930s and 40s. But here's what, you know, this is the picture on the left is an English class, an Americanization class that took place in the courtyard of the Ford Motor Company. And so they gave people that $5 workday, but in exchange you had to study English. Imagine studying English like that, thousands of people lined up in a row. You can't see the details of the picture, but they had like, you know, they would just hold up cards like teapot, and then they would hold one up soap, you know, shampoo. It wasn't, you know, a really vibrant English class. This is a smaller English class. So the city of Detroit was just really obsessed with trying to provide Americanization services. The Ford Motor Company was also, if you wanted that $5 workday, they were very disciplinary. You had to live in the way they wanted you to live. So they would go into someone's house, like the one on the left, And they would say, no, this isn't clean enough. You have to have curtains in your windows. You have to eat healthy food. You know, very often healthy food to the Americans. Imagine anything healthier than the Lebanese diet. There's nothing healthier than the Lebanese diet. But they would say to the Lebanese, no, you know, this smells funny. You have to, no garlic. This is, you know, something like that. They were always trying to reform people and their practices. This, again, should be a bigger picture. I'm used to a much bigger projector. You guys remember this is actually a picture of a melting pot. So the Ford workers, after working for the factory for a certain amount of time and after studying English, if they passed the English test, the workers would actually march into the melting pot wearing their traditional clothing from whatever country they'd come from and holding a flag, like a Syrian flag or a Polish flag or whatever. They would go into the melting pot, and the teacher had a big ladle. The teacher would stir the pot, and then the people would walk out wearing workers' clothing. They were Americans holding American flags. So it's really to sort of give you an idea of how serious America was in this period about sort of, you know, getting people to conform to a certain type of Americanness. So the immigrants who came here from the Middle East really were at a disadvantage in this period. So if you think about why did the community come here and then not grow, it's because it really wasn't, you know, new immigration couldn't come. So you had legislative discrimination that kept new people from coming to America. You had judicial discrimination, which kept the Jim Crow system in place for people from African American community. And you also had a kind of discursive discrimination, which was anti-immigrant in this period, that was sort of felt estranged from Islam in particular. So if you talk to people in the 1920s, their idea about Muslims was the Turks and the Armenian genocide. And that's what people knew about Islam in this period. So there was hostility and fear in this period too, not what we're facing today. But all of these things work together to keep the community from really growing effectively, to keep people from becoming citizens. And also the Syrian community in this early period was very committed to creating independence for their homeland. So there were a lot of the early Syrian associations were very concerned with the Middle East. Especially they wanted Syrian independence. They did not want the French and the British to divide up the Arab world. And they even went so far as to say, if we're gonna have a colonial power over rule over Lebanon or Syria at the time, we want it to be the United States, not France or England. As we know, history didn't quite work out that way. So all those Muslims who were working in Highland Park together, while there were these ethnic communities, there were also, they worked together across their cultural differences. So you saw Indian Muslims worshiping with Arab Muslims, worshiping with Turkish Muslims, and they were trying to build like a Muslim enclave in Highland Park. And the first thing they did was they built coffee houses. This should be familiar from anybody who grew up in Dearborn. You know, the South End, it had a bunch of coffee houses. They built mutual aid societies so they could bury their dead, so they could help their kids get married, send people home. They built ethnic clubs. There's a story about Mike Berry being in a 4th of July parade in Highland Park. I can't remember the year. But the Syrian club in that parade was the biggest ethnic club that participated in that parade. They had national associations, newspapers, right? But a lot of these associations were gendered. The coffee house was a male space. The ethnic club was a male space. So people used to worship in each other's homes. Sometimes they would worship in the coffee house. But the coffee house wasn't good enough. The thing that made the Syrian community different from all those other Muslim communities is the Turks came here just as men. The Lithuanians came here just as men. But the Syrians came here as families, right? So those families really wanted their kids to learn Arabic. They really wanted to celebrate the holidays together, right? So one of the first things they did was they built this mosque. This was the first mosque built as a mosque in the United States. Wasn't the first one to exist, but it was the first one. This was one block away from the entrance to that Highland Park factory. It was built by the Karoub family, the Karoub brothers, Mohammed Karoub and Hussein Karoub, and they also had a lot of assistance from Khalil Bezzi, who is the man on the left in that picture. So that's the opening day parade in 1921. They came together, they worshiped together, they built a mosque together. This was in Highland Park in 1921. This is a funeral. This picture was given to me by Haj Kamal of the funeral in Highland Park. I love it because it's got men and women in it. It's got children. And it's also got, like, you know, both the Syrian flag and the American flag. And it also has the American graveyards in that period used to have American bands that would come and play music for the funeral. So it was like a real mix of ceremonies. The picture on the right was taken in Salina Elementary School in 1923. So this shows you that the community started moving here, really. This is the second mosque that opened in Detroit. This one was why can't I think of the name of the street? It was in the heart of Black Bottom, the neighborhood that became Black Bottom. This was the Universal Islamic Society. Again, the man leading the prayer here is Khalil Bezzi. Right, so you can see in this period, Khalil Bezzi was a religious activist. He was also a political activist. He was the Detroit delegate to the New Syria Party, which was a Syrian nationalist organization here. And the two other people who were sort of the co-founders of this organization, one of them was the man he's hugging in the picture on the right, a Sudanese British subject, and the other one was a South Asian man, Shah al-Abedin. So they were coming together like we're colonial subjects of France and Africa and India and in the Middle East, of France and England, and we want our independence. That was the thing that brought them together. So Islam was a unifying force for them back in this period. Really, almost as soon as Henry Ford opened his factory in Highland Park, he started realizing that the city of Detroit was constraining him. He opened that factory in Highland Park, and the Dodge brothers opened their factory in Hamtramck, like on the border of Hamtramck and Detroit. And the idea was they were trying to get away from the city council of Detroit and how the city was trying to dictate everything to them, where to put their railroad lines, make them pay more taxes and stuff like that. So as soon as Henry Ford got his factory going, he started doing this. He started building this right here. This was a picture taken of the Ford Rouge plant in 1927. So he started investing in the Rouge plant, bought up all this land in the area. Here he could build, there were over 300 miles of railroad line that came in and out of the factory. He got the federal government to dredge the Detroit River for him. You know, all this stuff was happening. He had, over a mile of, factory. It was a huge production. And of course, Arabs followed Henry Ford to Dearborn. They came here, they helped him build the factory, and they started building houses in the neighborhood just beyond the factory, which is the south end of Dearborn. So there were, in 1920, there were 57,000 workers in Highland Park, but 10 years later, there were over 100,000 in River Rouge itself. And that's why I have this slide, to really show you how quickly these communities were growing. Just look at that. Imagine living in Highland Park in 1910, and 10 years later, the population has 40, it was a village of 4,000, now it has 47,000. Look at Dearborn, it went from 2,500 people in 1920 to 50,000 people 10 years later. Imagine, this was why so many of the houses that we see in Dearborn are all built in the 1920s or the 1930s, because this was when the city was being built. And Arab Americans, we think of Arabs as having been factory workers, and they were in this period, but they also built their own houses in the neighborhood, and a lot of them made money off of this real estate. The way that they were able to pay for that first mosque in Highland Park was Mohammed Karoub sold, or he bought a piece of property at the beginning of World War I, and he sold it at the end of World War I, and he made a fortune, so he got out of the factory, and he just started buying and selling real estate. And so the Arab community has always been involved both in the, labor, but also really been very active entrepreneurs. So then, of course, we're hit by the Depression. And in the Depression, a lot of Arab Americans go home. They go back to Lebanon. They think, we're going to ride it out there. It'll be easier for us to raise our kids in the village. Again, Mike Berry, his family went home. He was a kid. He'd grown up in the Highland Park public schools. He felt like he was getting a great education. They were brand spanking new schools, best teachers, best American curriculum that was available. And he went back to the village, and what does he have? He had a teacher with a chalkboard, like a slate for him to write on. And he was so upset because his mom, he and his sister had to go get water from the well so his mom could bake bread every morning. For him, this was like a hardship. So a lot of families went back to Lebanon thinking that they were going to be relaxed and easy, but they found that compared to their American lifestyle, it was actually hard to live in Lebanon in this period. So people started coming back when the jobs started coming back, and really this mosque right here, Hashmi Hall, was really sort of the start of a new beginning for the Arab community in Dearborn, right? People really, families would give a dollar a week or a dollar a week for every person in the family. They really saved their pennies and contributed and worked together very hard to make this institution happen. Hashmi Hall, it was the first mosque in Dearborn. Of course, it had just a few blocks away, you had the American Muslim Society. So you had a Shia mosque and a Sunni mosque. But as Ardella Jabara told me, one of the founders, or you know, from one of the founding families of the American Muslim Society, she said, "We all ate the same mujaddara," you know, which people were from the same place. They had the same customs. One year, once one mosque would have a good Sunday school teacher, and all the kids would go to that Sunday school. And then, you know, a few years later, the other mosque would have the good Sunday school teacher, and the kids would go down there. So people went back and forth and helped build up these institutions together. So, you know, this is what Dearborn looked like in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. But this whole generation of people grew up here. They grew up, people like Hajj Chuck or Hajj Eid, they grew up in the United States. They wound up going and fighting in World War II. You know, they came home after the war, and if you watch all those World War II movies, it's like all the units, and you know, every unit in the war had like an Italian in it, and a Jew, and a Pole, and you know, that's what the army did, is it brought all these people together and made them Americans. That's what the war did. That's what growing up in the South End did, actually, because the South End was a melting pot like that too. It had everyone in the neighborhood was the child of an immigrant, right? Everyone who grew up there, your parents could be from, you know, Romania or Poland, it didn't matter. Everyone sort of grew up together. But something happened in the 1940s at the end of the war. So this new opening happened with the Middle East. Lebanon gained its independence. And that generation of people who fought in World War II or who grew up in that period, they started looking around. You know, when they drove to the South End from their neighborhoods in Detroit where they lived or other parts of the metropolitan area, they drove down Woodward Avenue. They drove down Michigan Avenue and they saw big churches, big, big, big Roman Catholic parishes and Protestant churches and Jewish synagogues. And they thought, this Hashmi Hall thing, the coal mine, you know, because the soot in the neighborhood was so bad, the windows were always covered in soot. Or they used to call the Dix Mosque the basement. You know, these aren't mosques. You know, we want a mosque. We want something we can be proud of like these Christian churches are. So one thing they did, they also wanted someone who could really teach the next generation. They were worried that their kids were losing their Arabic. So they sent back to Lebanon, basically, for a scholar to come here and join them in America. And that scholar was Imam Shibi, who I'm sure all of you know. The Albanian community was doing the same thing at the same time. Imam Wahbi and Imam Shibi arrived in the same time. They were both wonderful scholars. They both did a lot to revolutionize the practice of Islam in America. So, again, this is what Hashmi Hall looked like. Imam Shibi, as long as that's not the adhan. I spoke on Sunday at a mosque, and the adhan went off in the middle of my my talk, and I got in trouble with the imam because nobody went to pray. So that wasn't on me. anyway, so when Imam Shiri came to Detroit, one of the first things he did in Hashmi Hall was he had a big hafli at Hashmi Hall, and he put a rug down, a big green rug. He rolled it out on the floor of the mosque, and he said, "I declare this a mosque." This was, you know, 12 years after the mosque had opened. A few weeks later, he had a similar ceremony where he announced the opening of a school at Hashmi Hall, which had also been teaching Arabic and teaching Islam for several years, right? So people weren't really happy with this. He didn't speak English. He said that what he wanted to do was sort of bring a new knowledge, new education to the American-born generation, but he didn't speak English. So as all of you know, I'm sure, he got kicked out of Dearborn. He went to Michigan City. While he was in Michigan City, he didn't waste his time. He learned English. He said the second thing that he learned, the most valuable thing, he said, other than learning English, was learning that women run the mosque. So when he came back to Detroit, he was a different kind of leader. He was the American Muslim Society was also growing in this period. This is their construction that took place in the 1950s, so it was no longer just a basement. Now it was a much nicer, grander mosque, looked like a mosque. That's Imam Karoub in the picture. This is what it looked like inside. He had always wanted it to be Masjid al-Am and not just the Baqa club, you know. And in this picture, there are a lot of Lebanese, there are Indians, there are Turks in the picture. But this is another thing that happened. This happened nationally, not just here in Detroit. The Federation of Islamic Associations of the U.S. and Canada got started in this period. And this was a very progressive national organization. The goal was for them to unify the Muslim community of America. A lot of the people who had fought in World War II, if you fought in World War II, you had to pick when you went into the army, were you going to have Christian dog tags Jewish dog tags. Well, you had Protestant, Catholic, Jew, and atheist. Those were your options. So you had to pick one of those. So if you were killed in battle, you would be buried according to that tradition. So the guys who had fought in the war, when they came home, they said, this is no longer good enough. We want the government to recognize our religion. So this was one of the main reasons they organized the Federation. They also, this is the year they had their banquet in Detroit, 1957. They also wanted to provide a curriculum for American kids to study Arabic and to, you know, have good, you know, Sunday school textbooks in their mosques. And they wanted a chance for people from small communities so their kids could know each other and they could marry other Muslims. And they also were upset about what happened in 1948 in Palestine. So they were upset at the role America played in not sort of challenging Israel. So again, they didn't turn their back on their religion, they didn't turn their back on their politics, they didn't turn their back on their families. These were the things that were motivating the community in this period. So when they had the banquet in Detroit in 1957, the main keynote speaker was Muhammad Jawad Shidri. And he spoke in English, and he gave an impressive sermon, something like no one had heard before in Detroit. And so that young delegation of men and women from Dearborn in Detroit got in their cars and drove to Michigan City and convinced Imam Shidri to come back here. This is a story you all know. Started the Islamic Center of America. That's what it looked like in 1962 on their opening day. Big crowd. Not exactly what people look like, especially women in mosques. Don't necessarily dress like that anymore. But so what was happening in this period is because of this period where we hadn't had immigration, there was a real move. We had the Civil Rights Act, which passed in 1964. We had the Voting Rights Act, which passed in 1965. So America was becoming more self-critical in terms of its racial history and self-critical in terms of its religious bigotry. So we were trying to promote the idea of pluralism. A lot of this came from World War II again. And there was a third part to that. They call the Immigration Act, which passed in 1965, they call it the third part of the American Civil Rights Act. Because what it was is it was the children of those Catholic immigrants, the Poles, the Italians, all those people whose families had been cut off from new immigration, they felt like the immigration law discriminated against them very specifically. They didn't change the immigration law to let in more Arabs. That isn't what they did, or to let in Asians. They changed it because so many ethnic white Americans felt discriminated against. But in 1965, we had a new immigration law, and it incredibly transformed the nation that we live in. I mean, it obviously transformed the city that we live in, but it certainly did the nation. So we had just a huge uptick in the number of people. We allowed 20% of the visas in this early period to come from those parts of the world that we had really had a total bar on. So that basically means Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. So there was like a favoritism, actually, for people coming from this period. You also had new laws that allowed for people to bring their children in, their dependents in. We also had new laws that allowed for the settlement of refugees. In the time, the refugees we were really concerned about were the anti-communist refugees. So family reunification, you know, so on and so forth. Students. So all these things, as we know, really changed the face of the Arab American community, because it just so happened that that immigration law changed 2 years before the 1967 war. It changed 2 years before the Civil War, you know, how many years? 8 years before the Civil War got started in Lebanon. We've had one war. So the big difference between the early immigrants who came is they came looking for economic opportunity. So many of the people who have come after 1965 came directly because of war. They've been either refugees or people who came here because they had family here and they had access to a visa. So it's been a real difference between the early period and the more recent period. But again, these institutions were going along about their merry way. They were American institutions. I love these pictures. This is Miriam Alwan's wedding at the Islamic Center of America. Here's Khalil Bezzi giving a lecture to the mosque. I love this picture because he's lecturing and Imam Shidri sitting quietly in front of him. But these institutions were growing and changing. So here, you know, some of the political causes. So still in the 1960s and 70s, the thing that drew people to Detroit specifically was the auto industry. There were jobs here. In the 70s, really in 73, 74, we had the oil embargo, and that started to really change the economy of the area. We also had in this period, you know, because of the 73 war, the UAW here in Michigan bought Israeli war bonds. And so the Arab workers got together and they petitioned the UAW to get rid of their war bonds. The UAW said, we're not going to listen to you. You're a small faction. We don't care. So what they did was they had the Organization of Arab Students, this African-American workers' movement, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, supported the Arab workers, and they created something called the Arab Workers Caucus, which basically shut down the Dodge main factory in protest over these war bonds. So it's mostly Yemeni workers, Palestinian workers, some Lebanese workers. So I'm mentioning Yemenis and Palestinians, which tells you the community wasn't just Lebanese anymore. It wasn't just Syrians anymore. It was starting to diversify, too. So this was a big moment for the community. The UAW sold like a third of their Israeli war bonds, not very many. It was just a gesture that they made. And they deported a lot of the Yemenis who were here working. So it was a Pyrrhic victory for the Arab community. But still, people thought it, you know, it really brought people together around this political issue. You also had at this time here in Dearborn, and this is also like a really important moment for the way Dearborn looks today and how the city of Dearborn grew. So that South End neighborhood where the two mosques were, where the Lebanese were, where the Arabs really were all coming, because those Palestinians and Yemenis, they wanted to be near the mosque. They wanted to be near the grocery stores where people spoke Arabic and where they could get, you know, all the ingredients that they wanted from home. But the mayor of Dearborn didn't like the South End. The South End was where all those radicals had been who were opposed to the UAW back in the early days. The South End of Dearborn was where the poor people lived who were always complaining about city services. The South End, as you all know, many of you might have never been to the South End. I have students today who have never been to the South End of Dearborn. I'm like, how can that be? that's the birthplace of your community. But the South End had all that pollution that I talked about before from the factory. It was hard to keep it clean. It was hard to provide services. And it happened to be separating the Ford Motor Company from the Levy Asphalt Company, which was just across the border in Detroit, and which had a deal that it had worked out with Ford where it was making slag. So all the byproducts of the steel production were going straight to Levy, and he was using them to make roads. So anyway, Ford and Levy, a lot of other people, Mayor Hubbard, got together, and they decided to rezone the South End for industry. They started seizing people's homes illegally, tearing them down. 350 homes were destroyed in the first period. Another period, we had lost another 200 homes. And this was all happening right at the time when there was war in the Middle East. So people were coming. People were feeling like really upset and frustrated and angry about what was happening overseas, and they were turning on the news and they were seeing all that stuff about the oil embargo and this new, you know, anti-Arab sentiment that was rising in American society. And here the mayor was trying to get rid of their neighborhood. So as it winds up, it was the Arabs. It was Ron Amon's mom, Catherine Amon, who actually, you know, worked with the Southeast Dearborn Community Council to file a suit against the city. And it was that Amon versus the City of Dearborn lawsuit that saved the South End from the wrecking ball. And again, this happened just as all these new people were coming, all these new immigrants were coming. It was also this moment where you had, you know, all these national organizations, the American Arab University Graduates, Association of Arab American University Graduates started in 1967, right after the war. Access started in 1971. The Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee started in 1981. So this was a period when the Arab community was coming into its own, was maturing, was growing, was trying to speak for itself, was working to represent itself. I need my glasses to turn. That's my alarm. Okay. I'll get there very quickly. So all this growth and change led to all sorts of revolutions that happened within the Arab community too. So the new people who came to America were like Sheikh Shiri had been when he first came, you know, 20 years beforehand. They were disturbed by the American Arabs and American Muslims that they saw. Those people looked really American to them. Not quite Muslim enough, not quite Arab enough. What happened? Why did these young people not speak Arabic? What's going on here in America? And so they were sort of frustrated. A lot of their frustration they took out on the mosques. The American Muslim Society, again, as most of you know, was taken over by the Yemeni community, by the Palestinian community. They banged on the door because in the old days, the holidays were celebrated on Saturday. They weren't celebrated on the day that Eid fell. People didn't get off work on the day that Eid fell. They had their main sermons were on Sunday morning because people had to work on Fridays. They would go to the mosque after work on Friday. But these new people said, no, we're going to pray on Eid. It doesn't count if we pray on some other day. So they broke down the door of the mosque, went in and started praying. And this led to this new revolution. The Yemeni community took over the mosque. And here they are. They really made the mosque grow. It grew. Now it's like really probably a bigger congregation than at the Islamic Center of America. It's a huge, really important, very influential mosque in the whole Michigan area. They also worked really closely with the African American community, and they still do. So as the Yemenis, the Palestinians moved into the South End, a lot of the Lebanese moved out because the Lebanese at this point had been here a long, long time. And they had resources. Their kids didn't want to live in the South End anymore. They wanted to live over in the other parts of East Dearborn. They wanted to move to West Dearborn. They wanted to move to Northville. So the community started moving out of that old occupational niche, too. The Ford Motor Company, the jobs it had, the good jobs were in engineering. They weren't on the line anymore. The community was getting educated. It was opening grocery stores and gas stations and making money. And so the community really transformed itself. So here's a picture that was taken at the East Dearborn Arab Festival, which we all know no longer exists, a few years ago. But I love it because that's the Dearborn we know today, right? A happy Dearborn. The Arab American Museum, which we're sitting in, opened in 2005. And most of America was thinking that Arabs were all going to have to go home after 9/11. But this community didn't go home. This community invested in itself. Really, really invested in itself. And a lot of the liberal establishment of America invested in it, too. This museum cost $14 million to build, and the Arab community probably gave a third of that. The Ford Motor Company, GM, the Ford Foundation, the state of Michigan, all these other people supported the museum, too. The Islamic Center of America, they opened their brand new building in the same week. It was very exciting to be able to go back and forth to those two events. We have, you know, Shatila is probably, if you talk to Arabs in other parts of America and you say the word Dearborn, the next thing they say is Shatila. You probably all know this. It's a great, thriving business. But we've got, you know, the old Berry Halal meat place from the south end of Dearborn. We've got cell phone companies, even Walmart in Dearborn, of course, now has Arabic products and Arabic speakers. We've got fancy... you know, I love the picture of Brome. Brome is that hamburger joint on the west side of town. Look at it. It's a hipster, cool joint. They tell you where their beef come from. So they tell you where their tomatoes come from. They don't tell you that their burgers are halal. Nowhere on the sign does it say it's halal. Whereas over in this end of Dearborn, we had that strip club a few doors down a few years ago that said halal chicken on the roof of the strip club. So Dearborn, to me, sort of exists between these two worlds, you know? That's Dearborn. That's the Dearborn we know. We've had a lot of elected officials and appointed officials come out of Dearborn, come out of the, you know, maybe literally, I know Rashida lives in Detroit, not in Dearborn, but she's a part of this community. I knew her grandmother back in the day. Ish Ahmed was the head of the Health and Human Services for the state. So in particular now it's becoming, it used to be we had a senator, an Arab American senator who was a Republican. That's becoming more and more scarce now. If Arabs want to succeed in the political establishment, they do it these days through the Democratic Party. Now we have an Arab majority on our city council. I know that slide's a little bit out of date. I love the fact that when the Arab majority, the first sort of vote they had to make, the big highly publicized vote was on the question of the garages, whether people could have the sliding glass doors on their garages or not. I love the fact that that's the controversy in Dearborn. It's not, as America looks at us and thinks about Sharia law, this is what the government's actually dealing with. And we have all sorts of innovations in terms of, like, you know, this is the south end of Dearborn. This is the Dix Mosque. They got tired of doing fundraisers for their mosque all the time, so they built, the mosque built this huge medical facility and brought in doctors and clinicians to rent the medical facility, and now it's like a traditional walk. The mosque runs off the income they make from the walk. It's a great idea. A lot of innovation happening here. Of course, Dearborn is also today, because it's such a big, influential, important, significant community, a well-known community, it attracts a lot of detractors. Of course, we all know that Terry Jones came here to burn the Quran, and instead he shot himself in the foot. I think I'm probably not the only person who enjoyed observing that. unfortunately, these guys who carry the pig's head, a literal pig's head around the East Dearborn Festival, have canceled the festival. The city won't do the festival anymore because they can't afford to insure it anymore. So the city continues to attract these detractors. But the city also has a lot of supporters. So this is the interfaith meeting that took place before Terry Jones came to town. People were really worried that the Shabab in Dearborn were going to like stone Terry Jones to death or create a riot or something like that. I was like, this isn't Afghanistan. This is Dearborn, you know. But still, it was a really powerful moment to see all these religious leaders from throughout. I remember when I drove up, I actually started crying. I called my husband on the phone and started crying because it was all non-Arabs going into the mosque. You know, usually I'm the only non-Arab going into the Islamic Center of America, or one of the, you know, few. But here I was, like, with everybody else. I just was very moved. Here everyone is standing outside in front of the mosque, showing their interfaith solidarity. And we also had more recently, in the current political climate we're in, with the travel ban that's being, you know, well, it looks like the Supreme Court is actually going to uphold. It doesn't affect Lebanon. It does affect Syria. It does affect Yemen. It affects this community in many, many, many ways. The Arab community went out to the airport to protest. And I'll tell you, because I've been to I don't know how many protests here in Dearborn, where, again, I'm like the only non-Arab at the protest. This was, Arabs were in the minority. America has come to recognize that when your rights are threatened, their rights are threatened. America, the liberal part of America, the part of America I identify with, has come to identify with you and to recognize that you're as American as we are. That's why all these people came out to the airport. So it really was, to me, it was just a beautiful moment. Even in this, you know, the how sad we all felt after the election and after the travel ban was like the first thing the new president did. But I also like this picture because it takes me back to the roots of this community. This community is not just any Arab community. It's a Muslim Arab community. And so many of the tensions and problems the community has faced over the years, and so many of the things that have strengthened and enriched and empowered the community over the years come from Islam. So I like this because this shows, here are these, you know, regular old Americans at the airport during the protest put their signs down on the ground and made a prayer rug, made the ground halal for the Muslims who were there to be able to pray. So this, in answer to your question about my next book, is this is what I mean by a halal metropolis. It's a space where Muslims are visible, where Muslims are empowered, and where Muslims are transforming the landscape, really transforming it in cultural ways, in political ways, in social ways. So that's my talk. Thank you. I'm sorry I went over my time.
Okay, we want to thank Sally for this lecture. If there's any questions or anyone would like to say something to... Yes.
So I hear this too. I've heard this story many times. I have friends who tell this story. And as a historian, I have to say, I have looked and looked and looked for the evidence. I have not seen any written evidence. I have not talked to anyone who says their father was on that ship. I think that there were Yemenis who came here. The Yemeni community and the Bangladeshi community had in common their experience with the British. They were colonized by the British. And a lot of them worked as merchant marines in the British Navy. So they worked in the coal rooms of the ships. They shoveled the coals. The British were like a lot of the American entrepreneurs were in this period. Like Henry Ford used to put the black people in the hot part of the factory, or he would put the Yemenis in the hot part of the factory because he thought dark skin meant you could do that kind of work. So the British put the Yemenis and the Bangladeshis in the boiler rooms of their ships. And a lot of these men, when they got to America, when they got to New Orleans or Baltimore or New York, they would jump ship and they would come to America. And a lot of the Bangladeshis who came to Detroit in this period were in that category. But I know the grandchildren of those men. I mean, there's like a record of those men coming here. I don't see a record of Yemenis being here in that period. Now, there are people who would contradict me, but I just personally, I haven't seen the evidence from it. I know that Yemenis were here in the 40s, and even in the 1930s, they started coming here. There was a mosque in New York in 1930 that was mostly a Yemeni mosque, and a lot of those Yemenis came and did work. Like Joe Baraggio's father was from that community. So see, I can associate one man with a mosque. But a lot of the other stories, I have not, honestly, I haven't seen evidence. Yes?
Just a moment, please. Okay. Just a moment.
Thank you, Dr. Sally. Appreciate it. I just want to let you know that she has a witness here. I came to this country in 1955, and I witnessed most what this history is all about. I remember the mosque in Highland Park. I remember when they built the mosque, which is now used by the Yemenis on Dix Avenue, American Muslim Society. I was a member of the Hashemi Hall, the Progressive Hashemi Society. I was the secretary as well. And then how the mosque was used to be meetings on the first floor, second floor was the mosque, and I remember Sheikh Khalid Bezri and Sheikh Muhammad Jawad al-Sharif, they used to pray up in that mosque, and there were not too many people praying. I can verify all this all the way to the new history at the Islamic Center when Terry Jones came to the Islamic Center and he wanted to tear, and they burned the Quran, and the hall of the community got together, and how the leaders, Christians, Muslim, and Jews leaders, and they put hand in hand protecting the Islamic Center, and it was great. That was that time as the chairman of the Islamic Center of America. So I verify that your history is the correct history, and everything said is practically, I live it. So thank you for bringing it to us.
Yeah, I'm just curious, do you know what's the percentage of Christians with those initial Arab immigrants that came to the United States?
Yeah. Well, I can talk. People can hear me, right? So this is also controversial because the immigration services don't ask your religion. And let's hope that they never do. When people came in the early, like in the 1880s, 1890s, early, very, very early 20th century, there was no Lebanon. There was, you know, Syria was part of the Ottoman Empire. And so people would put, initially there was a period when they put Turks from Syria. So they would put Turk as their identity first. So we have a whole period that people were saying Turks from Syria. Now, did that mean Arabs or did it mean people from Anatolia? Who were those Turks, you know? So it's not clear whether people were Arabs or Turkish to begin with, and then whether they were Lebanese, ethnically Lebanese or Syrian. But so the religious issue, the early immigrants from Syria were overwhelmingly Christian. The Christians started coming first because they had ties with the French missionaries and the Presbyterian missionaries, the American missionaries who were there, and the silk industry collapsed. The French had really worked to help build up the silk industry, and you know, it pushed people off their land. They started working for cash. They wanted sugar. They wanted coffee. They wanted rice, all these things they hadn't been able to have before. And then the men started going to America, and the women started working in the factories. And, oh, that was just huge social change. You know, this happened in Mount Lebanon. This happened first there. It took a little while for that news to trickle down to the Junub, right? And then the Junubi started coming really around the turn of the century, 1906, 1907, that period. So we think the best estimates we have are really estimates, they're guesses. But the assumption now, it used to be like the Lixanath used to say it was 95% Christian. And then Michael Suleiman used to say it was 90% Christian. Slowly, 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 we're working that Muslim number up to 15%. That's as high as Sarah Galtieri, who's the expert on this, has said so far. But we're working that number, we're rolling that Christian majority number back. I think also in this period, it was hard if you were, the first people who come are always men. men go first, and they kind of make their way and find security. And a lot of the Muslim men who came never went back. They got married to somebody else, you know. So we don't know how many of them there were. But it was really Detroit. It was the teens. It was that those jobs at Henry Ford that encouraged people to bring their families here. And it was the fact that they had families here that encouraged them to build the mosques. And it was the mosques that made the new people who came feel comfortable and drew people. So this is, there's like a, you know, there's a story here.
Okay. Just to add something to confirm what you're talking about Turks here. At that time, I remember very well when I was in Brazil, they used to call all those immigrants from that part of the world Turcos. Turcos means anybody who was living under the Ottoman Empire, whether he's Syrian, Lebanese, Turcos. Till now they call them, I think Haji, you know that when you've been to Brazil. Okay, any more questions?
Hi, my name is Talib Jamali. You know, as a Muslim, we meet with other religions like Christianity and Judaism with several values and principles. And the most important one is the recognition of God. And we all believe in family values, and we all fight tyrannies and oppressors. That means we all meet in common base in which we can produce a good life. As you know, as a Muslim here, we live about 10 years, tens of years ago, since 1920, as you say. And since that time, until about 10 or 7 years, 10 years, until now, the Muslim work and live peacefully, you know, until Daesh has come. You know, Daesh has distorted the religion of Islam. They describe Islam as a religion of violence and war, and which is not true. The Islam is religion always of peaceful and wisdom and cooperation with other. I do need to see your view about that. This is how affect the situation as a religion like Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. We work and live together in this country. Thank you.
So I have to say that it's like so refreshing to have Dr. Fawaz and Dr. Ajami. You know, usually when I get a talk, I get challenged. I don't get testimonial. So I really appreciate that. I want to thank you for that. And usually when I give a talk on the history of the Muslim community in Detroit, I get the same question you ask, but I get it from someone who hates Muslims. I get that, you know, you're telling us that Muslims are okay, but really we know, we watch the news at night, we know they're really not okay, so, you know, cut the bullshit. That's the kind of question I usually get along this line. So it's a relief to be speaking here. And the only thing I can say is that I don't 100% agree with you, because, I mean, I agree with you that Daesh is not, it's not the Islam that any Muslims I know recognize or identify. It certainly promotes faith, I mean, violence and hostility chaos. I mean, but it's not the first time Americans have seen this coming from the Middle East, right? And if you go back 100 years, like I was talking about when Americans in the teens and 20s, when Khalil Bezzi first got here, what Americans thought about Islam was what they knew about the terrible Turks and the Armenian crisis. And even when Utah, you know, 40 years earlier, when Utah had fought for statehood, they called Joseph Smith, the prophet of the Mormon community, they called him the Muhammad of the West, because the Mormons allowed polygamy. So that, you know, a lot of Americans just thought that Muslims were like Mormons. And that was bad enough. They didn't, you know, that was bad enough for them back then. The thing is what I say to my students and what I say to audiences that don't know anything about the Middle East is that a lot of the people who have come here from the region have come here because of that violence. They've come because they want security and stability. Their kids go to our universities. Their kids study on government, you know, fellowships. They go on to work for the government, to fight in the military, to build big museums. They're as American as apple pie. And the only reason the Middle East doesn't have peace and stability, it's not because of Islam. It's because of this colonial legacy. It's because the region got divided up and conquered. It's because the Western world wants the resources of that region and fights over them. It's because of the Cold War. There's just a long history of conflict in the region, and usually if you look into that conflict, the U.S. government, especially since the 1960s, has played a very, very strong role. And there's like a direct relationship between like the Iraqi community that's coming here today. I hope that soon you'll invite my friend Dr. Ahmed Al-Ansari to give a talk about his research on the Iraqi community that's been coming since the first Gulf War. I mean, he's doing really wonderful research. He spoke in my class a few weeks ago. It's a great talk. So the story of the Iraqis who are coming today is not unlike the story of the Lebanese who came here at the height of the Lebanese Civil War, or the Palestinians who came here after 67, or the Yemenis who are coming here today because of war, right? And in all of those wars, the U.S. played a role, you know? It's and that's why we're allowing these refugees to come here, because we're responsible at some level. That's not an answer about Islam, really. I don't really have an answer. I can't solve the problems of the Middle East. And I say to people, I'm not a specialist on the Middle East, fortunately. I don't want to be. And I'm not really a specialist on theology either. So when people ask me to defend the hijab or defend this or that or the other, I say I'm not. I will ask a Muslim to answer those questions. Okay. I hope that satisfies
you. Would like to say something, Susan?
You're welcome. Thank you all.
Just one more question, because we still have some poets. We love to hear poetry. So?
You mentioned the idea of melting pot, and you talk about some of Arabic communities that transform to be Americans so fast. I have seen during my study about Iraqi Americans, people, even they have been here for more than 30 years, still so much Iraqis than American, and some of them still cannot even speak English. And they still living the style of Iraq here. But they made like something mixed, but if you look very careful, you can see there are more Iraqis than the Americans. So how do you explain this?
Well, so there are two explanations. So first, it's that reason I started out with. The people who came at the beginning of the 20th century came voluntarily. They weren't driven out of their homes by war. They came here looking for economic opportunity, and they found it. Secondly, they came to a country that was filled with immigrants like them. They lived in communities that were filled with immigrants like them, but not literally like them. Dearborn was a melting pot. Dearborn had people from all over the world. The south end of Dearborn was in Ripley's, believe it or not. It was a neighborhood with 55 different languages were spoken. If people are speaking 55 different languages, in order for you to get along, you're going to have to learn to speak English, right? The Iraqis that you're talking about, they came ghasb anhum. You know, they came because of war. They didn't want to come. They spent all those years in a refugee camp before they came. They came to Dearborn, the Dearborn we live in today, where you can go to the bank, you can go to the grocery store, you can go to the doctor. There's not a service you want that you can't get in Arabic right now. So those are the two big reasons. And even you know that those immigrants told other immigrants, don't come to Dearborn, go to Ohio first, learn English, and then come to Detroit.
And that's true.
Because if you come to Detroit, you'll never that's learn true. English. But if you look at the children of these Iraqis, and I know because they're the students I'm teaching. The students or those Iraqis are just as American as any other student in our university.
They don't speak Arabic.
Well, most of them do because their parents really don't speak English. But you know, the children of these Iraqis, they really do still speak Arabic. But they're American, and their future is here. And, you know, that's the real difference. That's the real difference.
Okay, I can add to it's not only Iraqis, also Lebanese. I know a lot of Lebanese that they don't speak a word of English. Just for so simple. They don't need it. Mm-hmm. You are in a city where everything is provided in Arabic. So why? That's it. Okay. I just want to thank,
thank you.
Dr. Howell. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We'll see when you publish the new book.
Inshallah.
I thank you, everyone. We have 40 minutes left, and we have four poets, two in English, two in Arabic. We have divided the program into the first hour, 7 to 8, the Arabic program, and then 8 to 9, the English program. But today we mixed it because we started with an English lecture. So to mix the program, we're going to have an Arabic poet next, and then English, Arabic, and then English, and we'll be done. So next on the stage, actually I'll have Ali Sindi, يعرف الضيف القادم بأبيات من الشعر.
Good evening, everyone. مساء الخير مساء الشعر. جاءت حروفي بالمحبة حالنا فعسى تعود من المنصة غانمة وعسى تعود حبيبة للعبد لي في رحم أشعار الحقيقة نائمة مع شاعر الأستاذ كمال العبد لي الذي أرسل رسائله إلى النائمة في رحم ما وهو الأستاذ كمال ناجي مهدي العبد لي من مواليد عام 1946 في بغداد الكاظمية جاء من العراق حاملا الأدب الذي ينبع من أرض الرافدين وزاده عطاء التغرب فكتب وألف مجموعة شعرية باللغة العربية وباللغة الإنجليزية له كتاب في السيرة الأدبية له كتاب مخطوط في الأدب بعنوان فوتوغرافيا الأوراق ينشر العديد من القضايا الأدبية والمقالات وهو المشرف اللغوي في الجريدة المعروفة صدى الوطن فأقول له بيتا آخر وأقول صوت القصائد بالمحبة يعتلي شعرا وحبا من كمال العبدلي رحبوا معي مع ضيفنا كمال العبدلي
قد الوقت
نحن عادة الخمس دقائق
خمس دقائق
عادة الخمس دقائق
نلحق الخمس دقائق أعزائي الحضور الكرام السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته كم أشعر بالسعادة حين ألتقي بأزهار منتشرة متكثفة في حديقة ما هكذا أرى وجوهكم الكريمة الوقت بالحقيقة لا يسمح بقراءات تستغرق لأكثر من خمس دقائق لذلك سأقرأ قصيدة واحدة غير منشورة وكان بودي أن أقرأ شيئا من القصائد العمودية لكي أحلل لكم ولكي أبرر لماذا تأتي القصيدة النثر في جانب ولماذا تأتي قصيدة العمود في جانب آخر نلتقي إن شاء الله لقاء آخر ونتحدث حول ذلك اهتمامي في كتابة القصيدة ينصب على أجواء الهجرة التي نحن نعيشها عن مهاجرة محلقة اسمها مريم. من هي مريم المهاجرة؟ إنها واحدة منكم، ولأني ذائب فيكم فهي واحدة منا. هناك في الجنوب اللبناني كان اسمها في دفاتر الحكومة مريم، وبين اكتظاظ المسافرين تحت سقف المطار رأت باللاطاته اللامعات ثورة مياه وسط نهر بعيد، تدير رأسها دوران مراوح الدوخة بين موظفو الهجرة ينادون عليها ماري. ثورة الدوخة عينها دارت برأسي رغم اختلاف رقعة المطار وتقويم الرحيل. يوم نودي على اسمي بتضخيم اللام كمور، فالنبتة في الحقل واحدة إن كانت في شمال الحقل أو في شرقه، حتى إذا أشارت يد المهجر يوما بقبعته يعرفني إليها كانت تحمل سلالا من أزاهير الحروف، فسجلتها في دفتري نسمة الأرز كلما هبت تمايلت الرؤوس الآدمية بهارا. هناك في الجنوب اللبناني كانت فلاحة تنبت الأرض قمحا لتطعم الأفواه، فتمتد الأرض نماء حتى إذا فرش المهجر لها أرضه رأيتها ممرضة ترسم البسمات على الشفاه العليلة. كان اسمها في دفاتر الحكومة هذه المرة ماري، فسجلتها في دفتري ملاك رحمة. هناك في الجنوب اللبناني كانت تنام وهي تحضن جمرة الشجن، وتحت سقف المهجر أضحت لا تنام وهي تحضن حلم الوطن. ليست المسافات هي الفاصلة ما بين الجنوب والمهجر، بل دخان أزهار العمر. صار لها جناحان يتدلى تحتهما ثوبها الأبيض مرفرفا. صحت إلى أين يا مريم؟ أجاب الصدى إنها طائرة فوق شواهد الضحايا إلى حيث عرس البشرية. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
I'd like to introduce you to the next poet. Her name is Renaum, and she writes poetry in English, and she expresses a lot of her poetry of from the struggles of this area, from the spirit of the area that we live in. Renowned, she runs her own open mic show in two cities, one in Gross Point, right, and the other one is in Farmington Hills. So she runs two open mics, and she's a poet herself. I'd like to introduce you, Renowned.
Can I just do two pieces? Is two okay? Okay. Hi. Okay, how's that? Is that good? Okay. Thank you, Wissam, for inviting me to be here tonight. I appreciate it. I'm just going to do two pieces. This is one that I wrote. I was asked to feature it at Cocoa Lounge, where they have African and Caribbean cuisine, and for a special program they had. So I wrote this piece called Mother. I have never met my mother. She did not raise me, though she is the one from which I came at least 75 to 80% of me. This, according to DNA23 or Ancestry.com, I do not know. I do know that God gathered soil of her lands. It is evident in the melanin in the skin tone that my skin has shown since birth. The very chromosomes that ordered the pigment in the irises of my eyes wish only to see her in themselves. My hair curls on her cue, paying homage in my physical attributes that only she, my mother, could have bestowed upon me. I am the begotten from many generations of her lost and stolen children, transplanted to grow up in lands on the other side of the Atlantic and deep in the Caribbean Sea, all the while remembering vast lands ripe and Edenesque. While I can't recall the name of the country, uncertain of the specific regions, there are unconscious memories that whisper that the Nile runs through me. From Angola and Algeria to Zambia and Zimbabwe, you carry 54 countries wrapped in a chitenge on your back. The Afrocentric diaspora is transcontinental and global, and though our languages differ and our customs may vary, we keep you with us in our blood, in our cellular structure, in our beings, in our soul stories, and in all of our glory. Oh, mother, our mother, Africa. Thank you. This next piece is a little angry. Not that angry, just a little angry. I need a vacation. I'm going on very soon. So, but until then, my job's kind of been getting on my nerves, so this is therapeutic. It's called The Company Car. He stands over me, lobster red with too much sun that he clearly got from doing whatever outside task he did this weekend, with his two kids and his dog and his wife, the one who once told me at a Christmas party after her fourth glass of wine that she voted for Trump and that everyone is just too politically correct and that she could call me a black woman if she wanted to. Not that the color of my skin should matter in her stories, but clearly it does. Her husband is dangerously close to my side of the desk when he asks me why I haven't done this totally insignificant thing, why I haven't checked off these particular tasks, and all I can think is shut up. You do know that I'm killing it, right? That after 5 years, I've met and exceeded all of my goals every time. Every time. And because my old boss was too lazy to post this position, we ended up with you. You got the job because you asked for it, reaching some human resources policy, no doubt. Lazily, they gave it away to this incompetent imbecile. And here he stands in my office asking me about this. He doesn't want my assistant, doing this because this is part of my job. And then he says with a chuckle in his laugh, well, that's what I'm paying you for. He's wrong because he's not actually paying me. You see, the company is. And too many times he shows up without yelling surprise, visiting my office as if he's trying to catch me doing something unprofessional or perhaps something that would be worthy of termination. Meanwhile, My laptop sits out sunbathing in the fluorescent lights until it's jet black. Though freshly closed, it still hums as if it's hooked up to the power cord. And well, there's that mouse too, because I just don't know how to use the touchpad. Out in the open, my laptop tries to blend in with the top of my desk, but sticks out still like the only black person at every meeting I ever go to. And if he opens it, and the screen will reveal the poem and many more, but he doesn't ask about it. Still standing over me, leaning, leering over me, when 6 months ago, his position was beneath mine. Thank you.
صبحي سعد يا زينة الشعار حرفك أصيل ومبهر ومغوار جينا بمحبة نسمع حروفك يا ليت فينا كل ما سنشوفك عطر حفلنا بأجمل الأشعار عطر حفلنا بأجمل الأشعار طبعا هذا تعدي من الكار الفصيح على كار الزجل إن شاء الله يكونوا موفقين تفضل
حلو حلو يعطيك العافية شكرا لك يعطيك العافية وقت اللي كنا بالعشرين كنا نغني بالجوقة ولما صرنا بالسبعين صرنا نقرأ على الورقة انطلق فصل الربيع انطلق فصل الربيع بعنفوانه انطلق تيخبر بعظمة كيانه الوحيد بأربع فصول الطبيعة الورد والزهر بقدو مستعانه أعطانا عطر أزهار البديعة وفلش سجاد أخضر مهرجانه وفصله لنتهى منها أطيعة بيرجع عند ما يأتي أوانه ويا من تشرين هالأرض الوسيعة تنحفظ للوفا حب وحنانه ضروري تكون وحدتنا منيعة وضروري نلتقي بالشهر مرة وضروري الشعر نطلق له عنانه ويا دربن ع مسافات الطويلة ما بدنا بعضنا نربح جميلي عطيناك وعطيتينا المودة وفتحتي صدرك الغاي نبيلي يا درب ع مسافات الطويلة ما بدنا بعضنا نربح جميلي عطيناك وعطيتينا المودة وفتحتي صدرك الغاي نبيلي عطيناك الوفا بدل التعدي عطيتينا المحبة والفضيلة ووضعنا اتنيننا يدك بيدي وبشارع ورم عززنا التجارة صارت دربن الحلو الجميل وتلت مرت على الدهر وعناده وعلى طموحات ما قدرته وفساده هجرنا بلادنا برقة ولطافة وتركنا الأرز شامخ في عماده اوصلنا بالغرب رقم الإضافي وصرنا بالغرب الرقم الإضافي وشفنا شعبها الحقق مراده وشفنا صار النظرة او يا دربن لك رجع دربن او تنتمرد على الدهر وعناده وعلى طموحات ما قدرته فساده هجرنا بلادنا برق او لطافي وتركنا الارز شامخ في عماده وصرنا بالغرب رقم الاضافي وشفنا شعبها الحقق مراده وشفنا العيش فيها كتير صافي وحقوق محصن عليها اعتادوا اف نحنا وانا يا موطني رغم المسافي الك اشواق حب كتير زادوا ان شاء الله منلتقي بعد التجافي لو قلبي الحنون على اولاده ويا فاتح للشرق صدرك مضافي ب10,000 كيلو امتداده عطيت الغير شو معنى الضيافي ويلي حقوق يلي كفوف بالخير جادوا الشاعر في إلو تقدير وافي وأوافي بكر قدم لك فؤاده وبدي ضل أنظم لك أوافي حتى يسمع العالم صداها ونرد المهاجر عبلاده
شكرا
Last but not least, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Yusuf Al-Khamousi. Yusuf Al-Khamousi is a teacher, an educator, and a writer. He currently teaches at Fortson High School. He's a master's in English language and ESL. He currently has published, let me grab the book. Recently published a new book called Chapter 1. Yusuf has been published before. He's the author of several collections of fiction, poetry, short stories, and essays, including The Massacre of Heartbreak Morrow, Renegade Rebel, and the Gen Ed series on education. He earned his Master of Education from Wayne State University and teaches secondary English and history. He lives in Dearborn, Michigan. For more information, you can visit alqamousi.com. Yusuf's book is a representation of many things, one of which is the Arab-American soul living in this new era with all the complexities that this may carry. I am going to read a small section to introduce him. And this section is how he started his book. And so I suppose now, my fellow reader, comes the moment I assume you've all been waiting for, the magnum opus of this merry tale of absurd and inflammatory nonsense in which our holy protagonist sets out for adventure to find himself and seek a moment of astounding enlightenment amid daring trials and tribulations and perils and dangers and gallant quests and encounters with fascinating people and enlightening conversations and unforgettable sights and upon return from this great and wild journey, a new discovery of himself and the world around him and an opportunity for you, O holy, noble reader, to live vicariously through these incredible experiences and to dream of your one day when you will have the courage to undertake such a journey yourself. Very long sentence, Ranan, on this complex mind journey that was manifested physically in his trip that he decided to take to Costa Rica. I don't think that the destination has to do anything with the book. Wherever he went, I think that chapter one would have been produced the same way. So we're going to have a book signing. The Dearborn Open Mic will hold a special book signing ceremony in this hall. It will be done in August. We were supposed to do it earlier, but we want to give more time for the book to be printed, more copies, and to announce it even longer. So the book signing will take place in August. Without further ado, Mr. Yusuf Al-Khamousi.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Sharfuddin, always for that vivacious introduction. In the spirit of Chapter 1, Costa Rica, I'm just going to jump right into it. I'll take you now to that moment in which my dear friend Adam and I had our first surfing lesson at Playa Yaco, one of the great surfing capitals of the world. As we waded into the ocean, the smooth, steady waves embraced us candidly, and the water rushed our senses and our spirits. We waded farther and farther as Julian, our surfing instructor, advised us on how to proceed. We got on our boards, centered and belly down. We waited. He held down our boards until the right wave came along. Julian turned us around. Fura! Pado, pado! Stand up! And suddenly from behind me, a strong, sturdy force propelled me forward. With my right foot and back, I stood up and leaned forward and centered my left foot. And folks, on my very first try, I rode a complete wave. The rush was incredible. I screamed and hooted. It was such an addiction, and I paddled back, craving more. Adam was cheering and hooting and jumping around. I couldn't believe he'd never done this before. And it turned out that both of us were very decent beginner surfers due to our backgrounds in skateboarding and snowboarding, for those same mechanics came into play here, and we were ecstatic. After five or six runs, I was running three or four waves in a row. Then Julian asked if we were ready to go deeper, and of course we were, so it was time to get on our boards and hit the real waves. I watched with what grace, what calm, what submission Julian interacted with the water. For to resist or fight water in any way was certain defeat. But Julian knew the water. He was its child. He did whatever it wanted, or he got out of the way. So if a giant wave came his way, either he allowed the wave to take him wherever it was going, or he dipped below it and let it pass over him. No struggle, no conflict, complete tranquil, liquid submission. I saw this and watched admiringly this man's gentle surrender to the universe, for he understood that the ocean, the universe, the flow always wins. And those who try to order, to command, to conquer, to resist the flow, soon succumb to the flow. Yet those who succumb to the flow by their own wisdom find that the flow knows best, and they are at peace. I wanted to learn what Julian knew. I wanted to see into this mind of the flow, of the submission. He knew water. He understood water. So as we swam out into the ocean's great white-capped mountains, I called out to him, "So I want to learn more, like, I don't understand the water." And Julian looked at me and he said with a look of sheer bewilderment, "What do you mean?" And I thought, I sound crazy. So I didn't bother to explain further, and Julian didn't bother to ask. And I assume that this highly intricate, abstract, philosophical concept, which I've just expressed to you, must be something he knows intuitively, but isn't able to express or articulate. So I moved on, and Julian ordered that we begin to paddle out, paddle out, paddle out. I wasn't sure what he meant exactly, but I knew what paddle meant, so I did that after him. And as we swam farther out into high tide, the waves grew monumentous and solid and reached 5 or even 6 feet high, and you really had no chance against them. So they started tossing me sideways, and I called out to Julian, "How do I turn?" Meaning, how do I paddle myself in the direction I want to go? And with great frustration, Julian commanded, "Paddle out, paddle out, paddle out." I didn't know what he meant at all, so I kept paddling, but whatever it meant, I knew it didn't mean to just keep aimlessly paddling. See, Julian had a very specific plan in his head. Direction, purpose, technique, objective. It was all in his head, but he wasn't articulating it. And Adam and I were aware enough to ask, but either he wasn't understanding our questions or wasn't interested in answering. So amidst this enormous chaos of tidal fury, he just kept saying, "Paddle out, paddle out, paddle out." And that meant nothing to me if I didn't understand, one, what paddle out means in surfer lingo, 2, what or why we are paddle outing, and 3, what the objective is, like how do I know I'm doing the correct paddle out? And suddenly out of nowhere, Julian cried, paddle in! And I thought, paddle in? I'm still trying to figure out paddle out, paddle out, paddle out. Now you want me to paddle in? But whatever I was doing was wrong, because very soon I found myself drifted over 50 feet away and facing sideways and bombarded with waves, and Julian looked concerned, and the other surfers were giving me that look you give people when you're drifting into oncoming traffic at 5 miles an hour. So Julian swam to me and fished me out, and I could tell he had really lost his patience. But in truth, I couldn't understand why he had lost his patience. All he kept saying was, Rock, you need to do how I told you. And I wondered, when did he explain how to do anything like this? Because I would have remembered that. If he could find the words, Spanish, English, or otherwise, to explain what we were doing, perhaps I'd actually impress him. But he must have said palau, palau, palau over 1,000 times, and I still knew then and know now just as much what palau means as you do, my most illustrious reader. The bottom line was, Julian was teaching a teacher, and he couldn't teach. So I realized that unless I was going to bob out here like a shipwreck survivor, I might as well move on with my life. I told Adam I was heading back, and I semi-rode the waves back to shore, and that was more fun than palau could ever be. I sat on the shore and let the tide caress my feet and knees, and I played with the dark, ash-tinged sand and watched the ocean, the mother of our planet, do her earthly work. And it doesn't take very long of watching the sea or the sky or the earth before time slows down and you gently swirl into a new primal consciousness, and suddenly you and the rest of the universe all make perfect sense. So I sat there in the euphoric trance of the sea and sand for what seemed like a beautiful cyclical eternity, and when Adam came back, he was so damn geeked. And I was so happy to see him this excited. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Chapter 1 Costa Rica is available online. To this day, I don't know what paddle out means. I paddled and then I went back. I don't know. He was just angry. He never explained. Thank you very much.
نشكر الحضور الكريم وندعو الجميع للمشاركة وإلى لقاء آخر في الثالث في 20 حزيران June 20 is the next open mic. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله.